Think there's a difference between religion and spirituality? Can they be the same thing? Are they two sides of the same coin, or are they really best thought of as two completely separate and distinct entities? I don't know. It's an interesting question, isn't it? Maybe that's an artificial bifurcation. Maybe we shouldn't be thinking of them as two completely separate and distinct things. This might be a helpful way to look at it. I came across a website called liveanddare.com. An article by Giovanni on spirituality versus religion. And he says, this is kind of the way to think about the differences between religion and spirituality. He says, quote, religion asks you to believe, spirituality asks you to look. Religion has dogmas, spirituality has wisdom teachings. Religion wants obedience, spirituality wants experimentation. Religion speaks of sin and hell, spirituality speaks of karma. Religion wants to comfort you, spirituality wants to liberate you. Religion is external, spirituality is internal. Religion is the form, spirituality is the essence. Religion wants to convert you, spirituality wants to inspire you. And he concludes by saying, religion is an institution, spirituality is a journey, end quote. That might be some helpful categories or ways to look at perhaps some of the differences between religion and spirituality. I wonder, though, if religion can have aspects of spirituality in it, and spirituality can also have a religious component. It seems to me that looking at this issue just on the face of it, it seems like religion is much more about emphasizing what you believe and what you do, your actions, your rituals, your worldview, what you believe, and it's really critical that you get it right in terms of your belief system and your practices, the things you do within that religious system. And also it strikes me about religion, and we think about organized religion in general, there seems to be this sense that there's an intermediary between you, the worshiper or the follower of that religion, and the divine or God or whatever that particular organized religion is representing in terms of a deity. There's someone that you have to go through. There's an expert, there's an authority figure that is an intermediary between you and God. Whereas spirituality seems to be much more of a personal thing. I think, yes, you can have religion that has spirituality in it, but it seems like the more I'm exploring this topic of spirituality, it seems to me that it's more about a personal quest, finding out who I am and getting me in touch with what? Consciousness, nature? I'm not sure exactly. I'm on this journey of reconstructing after deconstructing, or I should say in the process of deconstructing. I'm also interested now in exploring this element of reconstructing. And in this conversation today with Andrew Jasko, we're getting it into this topic of spirituality and in his specific understanding of spirituality. We're going to talk about different models or different approaches. He talks about spirituality as a form of healing from the damage and trauma caused by religion. And it's all about moving forward. It's all about finding freedom, spiritual freedom, becoming a powerful, healthy human being. And the problem about religion really is that this is something Andrew talks about. And in my experience of evangelicalism and fundamentalism, it's all about this getting stuck in the analysis phase. And I can remember as a young guy in evangelicalism, growing up in the church, going to Bible college and seminary, I was told that I had to constantly watch my thoughts and take every thought captive to Christ. And this whole idea that it's like, should I be worried that I'm now worried? I'm stuck in analysis. I've got to be constantly judging my emotions. I can't trust my heart. The heart is wicked and desperately evil. And you get in this sense of worthlessness, and you know, you have low self-confidence, you're pathetic, you're broken, you got to be obedient to God. You've got to repress your emotions, certainly repress your sexuality. And this is something that Andrew and I are going to talk about today. It becomes like an addiction. They give us the supposed cure for our problem, the problems of humanity, and yet they don't somehow seem to deliver. At least my experience of evangelicalism, it never seemed to really deliver, but they always said, you've got to keep coming back for more, coming back for the cure. And in the case of so many people in evangelicalism and Christianity, it can become an obsessive, compulsive, addictive cycle. And it's extremely unhealthy, extremely damaging. It can cause anxiety, depression, PTSD. There's a long laundry list of psychological and sexual hangups that we had coming out of evangelicalism. And this is the question I really want to explore. And I'm glad to be bringing you this episode today with a returning guest that was on here a few months ago, Andrew Jasko, because he's really exploring, as I say, this idea that spirituality offers a form of healing from the damage, the trauma that was done to so many people by religion. So we're going to talk about that in this episode today. So that is coming up in just a few minutes. I just wanted to say that before I get into the chat with Andrew, there's a couple of really cool things that have happened. If you remember listening a few weeks ago, I had Janice Selby on the podcast. She is a trained counselor from Kelowna, BC, an ex-fundamentalist who now has come out of that. And she actually helps people who are deconverting, who are going through spiritual transitions. Well, just a couple of days ago, Janice emailed me the kind of rough draft of a new course that she's going to be coming out with, I think in January of next year. It is called Divorcing Religion Workshop. She'll be doing that as an interactive course, and I think it's going to be super helpful. So stay tuned for more information about that. That's going to be coming up, I think, as I say, in January of next year. And then Amanda EK, who's a new friend on Twitter as well as on Facebook, just sent me an email copy of a brand new book from Suspect Press. And it is called Carnality, Dancing on Red Lake. So I'm really going to be interested to dive into this new book that Amanda sent me, as well as taking a look at the course that Janice is doing. So I'm super excited to be helping to get the word out about these really exciting new projects. I just wanted to say too, before I get into the chat with Andrew in just a minute here, if you want to support Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, that is a huge help. Consider supporting the work that I do. You can find the links to my Patreon page in the show notes. What you get as a reward for being a Patreon supporter is early release of episodes every Wednesday, as well as access to my course that I'm building, one module a month. I've done two now, and I'm going to be putting another one up here in December about deconstructing God. I've done one last month on deconstructing inerrancy, looking at this issue of how the Bible is used, misused, and abused in evangelical churches and some of the damage that that teaching has done to people like myself. And maybe that describes you as well. And this is something I know that's near and dear to Andrew's heart because he's doing a PhD right now. And this is his whole focus is, as I say, discovering ways to heal from religious trauma. And he's doing it through exploring spirituality. So let's go on into the conversation with myself and Andrew Jasko. I'm glad to be welcoming him back to Mindshift Podcast. Let's go on into it and see if we can't do some healing of religious trauma through spirituality. I'm so happy to be welcoming back Andrew Jasko. Thanks for being back again a second time on Mindshift Podcast.
It's great to be back, Clint.
We did our episode about, 4 or 5 months ago? You were just about ready to do a seminar in the San Francisco or Oakland area. How did that go? And what can you tell us a little bit about what you were talking about back then?
Oh, it was awesome. It was on reclaiming sexuality from religion. So we primarily talked about the psychological damage of religion on sexuality and repression, women's issues, gay rights, and just purity culture, all kinds of things. So it went really well, and I'm actually putting it on again at my school, California Institute for Integral Studies, in about a month.
Yeah, you're in the middle of doing a doctoral degree at that school on this kind of thing. This has become your passion, hasn't it, is looking at the damage specifically done by fundamentalism or evangelical type religion, and then helping people to heal in various capacities. So I'm really interested to hear what you're doing and how this is all going. I'm glad that we're able to come back and circle back around, because obviously you've learned a lot. You've done a lot of writing. You've been very prolific on your blog. I read a bunch of your articles today, and it's quite fascinating. I was cutting and pasting a lot of quotes, you know. In fact, I just tweeted one It was such a good quote. I thought this will make a good tweet. So I've stolen your material, but I did give you credit. So we got that going for you. I didn't just completely rip you off.
Well, steal away. I don't really mind. If it's good, go ahead and use it.
Well, I always give
That's
credit
what
for
really
it.
Matters.
Credit where credit is due. What is it that
Thanks.
Makes you, what is it that makes you so interested in helping people heal and looking at the effects of the toxic effects of religion? Because I remember when we talked in our podcast before a few months ago, a lot of it was around this topic of the damage, the emotional, the psychological, the sexual damage done to people. How do you come out of that? And why are you so passionate about that kind of journey?
Great question. I think that religion tends to repress and oppress people psychologically and spiritually. And for me, psychological and spiritual healing are kind of two sides of the same coin. And that's something I'd love to get into. I'm really almost more interested at this point in exploring spirituality. And so I know that's something we can really get into. I think that spirituality is healing. It is the healing from religion and the trauma of religion. So I'm really interested in getting into the damage that religion has done, addressing it, calling it out, because people are suffering under particularly fundamentalist forms of religion. People are really suffering, and they're suffering from the fallout, and people in it are suffering. So we need to bring awareness to the issues and move forward so we can be free, spiritual, powerful, healthy human beings.
And you pointed out in the last podcast, you said that even if you're not a religious person, even if you weren't raised in any sort of religion as a child, you've been affected by religion in society, in the wider elements of society. One of the things that you wrote about was the Puritan or the Protestant work ethic, for example, that even though you may not have been raised in any sort of religious context, that still lingers on, especially in more Protestant societies, and it's done a lot of damage to people, even if they haven't been in any way associated with religion personally. They've been affected by it, haven't they?
Yes. It really, religion has formed the way we understand morality and just a lot of messages in society. For instance, you mentioned the Protestant work ethic. So this is an idea that came out of Calvinism and kind of the idea that your worth is connected to what you do. It's really a political, religious, economic doctrine. And you hear it preached from political pulpits all the time that hardworking Americans are the ones who deserve life and liberty. And this is essentially the law of our society and our land and our economic system. It's about worth connected to work. And within this Calvinistic viewpoint, work, good works demonstrated your salvation. So there was kind of a connection between knowing you were saved and producing good works, producing money, doing things. And so when we attach our values to things instead of people, we as society become mentally ill, and depression and anxiety are rampant, are symptoms of this sickness of tying our worth to things that we do instead of who we are as people.
Yeah, I was reading today, there was a study, I think it was in 2009, by, I think it was Norwegian sociologist or scientist, and they wanted to test that kind of thesis of Max Weber, that he was the one who kind of came up with the notion of that there was such a thing as the Puritan or Protestant work ethic. And they discovered that societies that have a Protestant background, people feel worse about themselves when they're unemployed, or when they feel like they're being lazy, or they feel like they're not producing enough, as you say. So even if, again, if they haven't been raised within a Christian context as a child, they still have this lingering sense of worthlessness and laziness and feeling bad about themselves, even if they're not working or producing. So they're not worth something. It's quite an amazing thing, really.
Yes. And this whole notion is really epitomized and tied to God's law, the idea of the law in the Bible and in the gospel. And it's a burden that it crushes people who are broken and disenfranchised and disabled, who can't work for whatever reason. And it suffocates people who grit their teeth and who bear it, who try to work and who end up even being successful. But it produces short-term results by burning out and sucking out your life energy because it's materialistic. It ties your worth to what you do, and it makes things about willpower, and the biggest sin is laziness or not being able to do things. And instead of living from the heart, it's about doing. It's about production. And it's really kind of a soul-destroying work ethic.
And there's a flip side to it as well. They've also discovered that people feel better about themselves when they're producing, when they're working. So you've got kind of a double whammy there, haven't you? On the one hand, you feel bad about yourself. You feel shame and guilty when you're not contributing. But the one who is producing and compiling wealth and all that feels better about him or herself. So it's a double whammy, isn't it?
And it's a form of masochism. Really, people are looking for a reason to justify why they hate what they do. And this whole idea of grit and sucking it up and bowling your way through and life is hard. A lot of the times it's a way to justify not enjoying your life and why you resign yourself to a life of quiet misery, believing that hard work and success is about suffering. And there's an aspect of truth to that, right? We all have to do things we don't like. But when that becomes the dominant thing, we're no longer alive, all right? We become slaves in a system of law, someone else's external system. And this whole idea of willpower, people want to be worshipped for their willpower. Willpower isn't a real thing. It's a secondary thing. It's the result of having access to your joy or yourself or your motivation. And so, like, let me ask you a question. Do you need to teach children how to play, how to do what they love?
Absolutely not. They just, you just throw them in there and they start playing. They don't have to be taught any
exactly.
of that, do they?
So we, in our society, we need to learn how to play again, to connect with our hearts, to follow our intuition, to do what comes naturally to us. And when we reach these flow states, which is a part of spirituality, by the way, we find that work becomes a joy. And I know people, I guess even like me now, what I'm doing, as I thought that I was lazy and had trouble working hard and procrastinating all this, but now it's a joke when people do all this bragging about working hard and all this stuff, because I'm like, I'm just having fun. I'm just playing. It's not even like a thing. And the hard work I have to do comes a lot easier within that context. But this whole idea of your worth being tied to what you do, it's almost like a form of human sacrifice. It's like the sacrificial rite of ripping out your heart to gain the deity's promise of eternal life. You die in the process of making this hard work, this success, the goal, instead of living from your heart, from your center.
I can definitely resonate with what you're saying, because recently I flew back from Seattle and it was a very long flight. I had to go to LAX and it was a long layover. I was really jet lagged when I got home, and I had to rest. I needed to rest. I was tired. I was jet lagged. And one of the days I just basically spent sitting in front of the TV doing nothing, but I was telling myself I was resting, but I felt bad. You know, there's always that sense, like you say, of I'm being lazy. I should be doing something. I should be accomplishing something, anything, but I wasn't. I was just sitting here watching TV all day. But you know, that conscience is going, hey, you're not producing. You're not doing anything productive. Get to work, get busy, find something to do. It's unbelievable how that just stays with us, even though we've maybe disconnected from the religious component. Why am I feeling so guilty and so bad about myself for really doing something I need to do? I need to rest.
That's right. And religion places a premium on obedience, on doing over being. And it talks about living out of the heart and being, but it has also a mixed message about not being able to trust your heart and about good works being the center, the central aim. And this is really a form of slavery. And this gets into a lot of things about the kingdom of God and the law, if we can get into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But so in the Bible, obedience is primary, not love. God is more about obedience than about love, because you're only loved if you are a certain way. You're not really loved because of who you are. You receive love if you obey, and if you disobey or disbelieve, you receive condemnation. So this is not unconditional love. This is the definition of conditional love. It's love with strings attached. And that is a manipulation. what it's saying is, I will accept you if you give me what I want. I will accept you not for who you are, but for something that you give me, whether it's a feeling, whether it's your service. It's something that I'm getting from you. It's not actually you, because it's dependent on what you do. And so obedience is primary in this system, and love is kind of a secondary thing. It's in the Bible, but obedience, it starts at, this is because of the kingdom of God. This is the relational framework and context of the Bible, is a king to his subjects. God is the king. He starts out by creating humans, Adam and Eve, as kind of vassal servants. They're to rule and dominate creation and subject it and bring it to under God's kingdom rule. And then God gives the people his law, which is in essence to prove their devotion to him and to bring them under his control. It's about obeying him. And the law of God, I don't know if you struggled with this message of the law, but Paul talks about it as something that's kind of intentionally meant to break your will.
Yeah, yeah, it was supposed to lead us to Christ. That's what his argument was, wasn't it? It was to show us how sinful and bad we really are, and that would then somehow magically lead us to say, oh, well, we don't need all the law anymore. We've got Jesus now, so we're okay.
Yeah, the law is designed to break you like boot camp and to really put you in slavery to the divine master. It's designed explicitly in the Bible, it says this, to crush your faith in yourself, to crush your confidence in your heart and in your intuition. So the Bible says the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? Who can heal it? And it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to him and he'll make your path straight. So there's this implicit message that you can't trust your intuition. You can't trust your heart. Instead, you need to surrender your agency to everything that this deity says. And this is a master-slave relationship. It breaks self-confidence. It creates a sense of inadequacy and helplessness, so that you're always looking for the solution to the leader. And the law, it makes confidence impossible, because the standard is always raised, so you always fall short. Your best is never good enough in Christianity. Even if you're doing the most perfect good works, you know, there's still something wrong with you if your thoughts aren't perfect or your feelings aren't perfect. And so by crushing our self-confidence and by making us feel miserable and worthless, it makes for the perfect kind of slave that slave masters pride. Those who have low self-confidence, who are broken in, pathetic and obedient. They have to look to their master for everything.
Yeah, and I like what you said about these crimes of emotion. One of your articles, you were talking about this, that in Christian fundamentalism and in a lot of evangelicalism, we see, you said, it criminalizes normal emotional expression. It trains people to repress their feelings, because a feeling or an emotion isn't just bad. It's a crime against God. And you get into all kinds of problems when you start saying, like you said, I can't trust my heart. I can't trust my emotions. It's probably a bad thing. It's a crime against God. And that leads to, as you point out, fear, guilt, shame, all kinds of negative emotions and worrying about worry. And then you're just in this sort of obsessive state where you can't ever seem to get out of it. You can't trust your own emotions. And it just leads you down this terrible road of trauma and all kinds of problems.
Yes. The idea of sin, which is how this message of salvation takes root, is soul trauma. It's soul wounding. It disrupts your relationship to yourself. It's basically saying you can't believe in yourself, because your fundamental sense of self, or a core of your identity, is broken. It's fallen. It's bad. And so this is really a root for addiction to take place, by the way, is when we feel powerless and we feel disconnected from ourselves. That's when we look to external things to help us, to give us guidance or to solve our pain. And so this religious system can function really as a drug in a way, and get us caught in this cycle of suffering. And for me, spirituality is about repairing the self relationship, because this really breaks down our relationship to ourself. You can't trust your heart. You can't trust your intuition. You can't trust your critical thinking. There are parts of, I'm at war with myself because of my sinful nature. So that there's this really, this deep soul wounding that takes place. And part of the solution to this is, are things like self-love and following your heart and understanding your own freedom and like what intuition is. And I think the emotions, you talked about the crimes of emotion. This is really a core thing. Just looking for me at the psychological unwellness, that an emotional toxicity and repression that religion can create. Normal, healthy emotional expression can be criminalized, and we're trained to repress our emotions. You know, negative emotions aren't just unpleasant. They can become crimes against God. And scriptures talk of emotions sometimes as sins, emotions like anger or worry. Worry can be a lack of faith, or as these like dangerous mental states bordering on sin, like being covetous or jealous or having anger. You know, it might not be quite sin, but it can kind of get into sin really quickly. So what we have to do then is change these negative emotional states as soon as possible and replace them with positive emotional states through spiritual disciplines. You remember spiritual disciplines, right?
Oh, yeah. Accountability groups. I was part of many an accountability group. Someone holding my feet to the fire. Did I read my Bible enough? Did I pray enough? Did I do all the right things this week? Yep. I was in many a group.
And these can be really oppressive. And what they do, we're taught to turn to God whenever we're quote unquote struggling or when we have these negative thoughts or emotions. And that's a form of emotional bypassing. We're not being present with ourselves. We're not listening to our pain or saying, why do I have this emotion? We're just trying to stuff it out of consciousness because it's a threat to our survival and our well-being because it can lead to sin. And we're taught in the Bible, God says he searches the hearts and examines the minds to pay back every person according to what they've done in Jeremiah 17:10. And it says in the Bible, take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. So what happens here is this obsessive compulsive cycle. We're training our minds to be obsessive compulsive and to have this drug addiction type mentality where we're always reaching for God, for good works, for the Bible, for spiritual disciplines, instead of facing our pain and instead of going to the root of the issue. I mean, things like I used to pray the sinner's prayer thousands of times a day to try to get rid of my painful emotions and my fears.
Yeah,
and,
I did too.
You know, what this does is it only fuels the addiction. When we repress these emotional states and try to shove them out of our consciousness through Christian therapy or Bible reading, it's like a drug. It gives you a momentary, quick release, but it ultimately increases the buried emotional pain, and that will find its way out into unhealthy expressions and symptoms in our lives in different ways. And it reinforces the sense of powerlessness. It actually fuels the addiction. It's funny. These spiritual practices claim to set us free from judgment, right? But then they end up reinforcing the very judgment that they claim to set us free from by telling us you're a sinner. You know, you need forgiveness. You're being forgiven. That's reinforcing the message of danger.
Exactly. That's why I say the good news of the gospel really isn't the good news at all, because it puts you on this treadmill forever. You don't know that when you're getting into it, of course, at first, but it puts you on a potentially legalistic treadmill, like you say, getting us into obsessive thought and worry and concern. And then we're worried. Should I be worried? I shouldn't be worried about it. You know, even going back to the Protestant work ethic, one of the things I was reading about today, this whole issue of Calvinists are teaching this double predestination. Some are destined to heaven, some are destined to hell. There's nothing you can do about either one if you're one of the elect or not. So how do you know if you're saved? Well, they began to obsess about it. You know, am I doubting my salvation? Maybe that's a sign that I'm not one of the elect. And you can hear the obsessive thinking. Of course, then they come up with the answer, well, worldly success is one of the signs that you're saved. So there's the beginnings of the Protestant work ethic, but that obsessive kind of thinking is still with us even today.
Yeah, and it gets us stuck in analysis, because emotions and thoughts, they always try to stuff them into virtues or vices and put a moral framework on something that is not really an issue of morality. So we're always caught analyzing ourselves and beating ourselves to death by trying to moralize everything. And really, emotions are not good or bad. They just are. Even a really powerful, like a desire to hurt somebody, it isn't necessarily bad. It reflects an inner truth about your experience and where you are. And so the solution to having these painful emotions isn't to judge them. It's actually the opposite. It's to be with yourself and your emotions with non-judgment and curiosity. It's saying, what is this emotion trying to tell me about my suffering and my pain? And questioning it and getting curious about it. Even these really painful, dark, or scary emotions. And being compassionate towards yourself and loving. And emotions are doorways into our unconscious minds, our negative behaviors, our traumas. And, you know, they're friends, they're teachers. They might be obnoxious friends or, you know, really unpleasant friends, but they can lead us to health and greater awareness. So emotional health is not the stuffing of our emotions, and it's not rejecting unpleasant emotions as sins or toxic. It's being present with those emotions, actually. It's being fully present with ourselves. That's emotional health summed up. Being present with the fullness of your experience, the positive and the negative.
I like what you said about this whole issue of going back to the dualistic thinking in fundamentalism and evangelicalism. As soon as you start with that bifurcation, that oppositional category of virtue and vice, good and evil, then you say, well, basically, like you say, a Christian can't just experience his or her emotions. They've got to analyze them, subject them to all this moral scrutiny. You got to be thinking now, is this a worthy emotion? What does it say about where my maturity levels are? Is God going to be pleased with this? And you're overanalyzing, as you say, you're getting stuck in the analysis phase, and you can't just experience your emotions in any sort of healthy way.
Exactly. It's a form of repression, and it puts us in this obsessive, needy, and unhealthy state. And it is based on dualistic worldview, for sure. And there's more to this as well, this emotional repression, specifically relating to anxiety. I experienced a ton of anxiety as a result of religion. And that's because fundamentalism operates by creating a sense of unsafety. Anxiety can be a main driver of religious devotion. One of the main ways fundamentalism does this is through exaggerating threat. So, you know, life and the universe has plenty of dangers, right? You can get in a car accident, you can die.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
In our day and age, most of the dangers are manageable. Really, most of the threats we face are imagined, not real. Dealing with anxiety in our society is really more of a danger than like actual unsafety, than not having food. That's the main issue. And so religion creates way more anxiety by exaggerating these threats, by making imaginary threats real.
The fear of hell, for example, you said in our last podcast, that's really the ultimate ace card that you can play. You can't imagine a worse fate than an eternal conscious torment in hell. But whether or not it exists, that the very real fear that it might exist and that you and I might go there, that's going to be anxiety producing for sure.
Very, very anxiety producing. And in this system, hell, yeah, you're right. Hell is one of the craziest imagined dangers. But then the mind is a dangerous place. Your own mind becomes the most dangerous place to live because your thoughts or your lack of faith or your emotional crimes in your head have the power to throw you into the hell or to bring God's judgment or loving discipline, as they call it, which I think is hilarious.
Loving discipline.
Yeah,
I'm doing this because I love you, son or daughter. Yeah.
What'd you say?
I'm only spanking you because I love you. That's the classic connection to Christian parenting, isn't it? I remember hearing that thousands of times after every spanking. I'm only doing this because I love you, and it's because of what God wants us to do, you know, how to raise your children. So, yeah, it's connection right in there to the parenting of fundamentalism, too.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The sense of judgment is pervasive.
All pervasive.
And these threats, too. Like, you can die at any moment, and you better make sure that you're right with God, right?
Yeah.
So all these threats of these exaggerations of the danger, and then the world is an unsafe place, too, because of worldly influence. So we have to be afraid of our people who don't have the gospel, because they might tempt us and cause us to lose our salvation or bring judgment
down,
or even national invasion. So the sense of unsafety being in your own mind, of unsafety from other people who aren't religious, or of catastrophes in the form of God's judgment or demons. Think about kids with demons. They already have to deal with monsters under their beds.
Yeah.
Now monsters in my brain is a whole other level of terrifying.
That's right. Imaginary monsters that are somehow unseen, but they're absolutely real. They're out there. They're going to get you. That would definitely produce anxiety.
So we have here paranoia. We have anxiety. We have these horrible threats. We have emotional repression. We're trained to repress our emotions through a drug addiction of rituals prescribed by the religious system. We're trained in obsessive compulsive behavior. When we have these things that we sense as threatening us, we go to a ritual, and obsessive compulsive rituals like hand washing, for instance, when somebody is afraid of germs with an obsessive compulsive issue, they often compulsively wash their hands, but that very behavior reinforces the act that it tries to stop.
Exactly.
So it's this vicious cycle, and
it's very unhealthy.
It is. It's also it's traumatic. It's traumatizing.
So you have someone, as you're describing, who comes out of religion. Let's say now you and I both have come out of fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and reading through your articles, I can definitely resonate with most or all of what you say and what you're describing, the effects on my psyche and the anxiety and the depression and the obsessive overthinking, overanalyzing, and all that stuff has done damage to me and you and to a lot of other people. But now, where do you go from here? Let's say you've come out of that, but you've got all the baggage from that to deal with. How can you get healing going into the future? Again, this kind of reconstruction piece, because I always thought the deconstruction of all that was kind of the goal, but I realized there's more to the story. There's the healing piece, the spirituality piece. How do you start putting those in there?
That's really the essential question, and I think one of my frustrations is that we often stop there when we talk about religion. A lot of the discussion to me seems like just about the abuse and the trauma, and then not about the healing or about spirituality. So from my perspective, it's about repairing the self-relationship, how you relate to yourself, and the relationship to the rest of reality, what my place is in the world and my connection to that. And for me, that brings spirituality into the equation, and getting into a discussion of atheism and spirituality. And interestingly enough to me, I've been thinking about this recently. Religion has a long history of oppressing and stamping out spirituality. Everywhere that this imperialistic force of religion has spread, they've labeled indigenous spiritualities and practices as witchcraft, as paganism. And the people who practice them are witches and warlocks and sorcerers, to be feared and even killed. And they're superstitious. They can result in demonic possession. And I've examined my own experience of spirituality. I've been opened up to spirituality through things like psychedelics, yoga, meditation, studying of Eastern spiritualities. All of these things are labeled as evil and demonic by religion. So it's so interesting to me that, like, the core of spiritual practices for me now, like the real ones, are what religion tends to label as the scariest, worst things, because it wants to monopolize spirituality, and it often claims to be spiritual. Like, people will say that religion is spirituality, but I think it really tends to suppress spiritual experience and make it really difficult for people. And so I really wish that religious people could experience spirituality. And this is funny, because when I was religious, I preached spirituality, but I didn't experience it. I talked about how we should see signs and wonders and miracles. And now that I'm not religious, I'm experiencing this kind of stuff all the time. And it's crazy. It's wonderful.
How ironic.
But there are a lot of issues.
Well, I can remember when I was an evangelical, hearing things and saying things. I remember what you were talking about, being warned against the dangers of, quote, spirituality. I even heard some people say that you shouldn't study martial arts because it will open you up to Eastern religions and Eastern philosophies and worldviews and even perhaps demonic oppression. You shouldn't do things like yoga and they warned us against them, like you say, and yet here's all the potential benefits that people could experience, but no, they can't because, as you said, they're warning us against all the dangers of what might actually be authentic spirituality, ironically enough.
And part of the reason for that is that spirituality tends to emphasize freedom, individual expression, following your heart and the voice of your intuition, raising self-awareness, and an individualization of the spiritual experience. So within the spiritualities that I study and practice, it's all about your personal experience and not listening to anyone else's authority or dogma. You're the bottom line. And even in a sense, you are God in a kind of metaphorical sense. Christian mystics were often persecuted and killed for this very reason, because these types of views tend to make people break out of this master-slave relationship, this obedience orientation, this approach that leads itself to being dominated.
Someone said on Twitter the other day when I posted on this about how have you as an ex-evangelical or ex-religious person, how have you found or have you found any spiritual practices that have been helpful in your reconstruction? And one guy said, it's all a bunch of superstitious twaddle. It's all nonsense. I've rejected the whole thing. And I think, okay, wait a minute. That surely is going too far the other way, because we have to be careful of just rejecting something out of hand. Maybe that's a reaction because of all the warnings that we got when we were in the system, that we can't trust even spirituality, or it's all just a bunch of superstition. So there's got to be a healthy balance in there, surely.
Yes, and I really want to validate that kind of response, because I really relate to it personally and understand where that's coming from. You know, when I left religion, I had my guard up big time, because I saw how I was manipulated, and especially I was in the charismatic Pentecostal church, and it was all about following God's voice, which really led me into a lot of harm. I lost sight of my rationality and my responsibility, because I was always looking for God's voice or a miracle or a sign and a wonder, and it was opposed to science. And so one of the questions that I think we have to ask ourselves is, like, looking at spirituality, this fear of losing touch with rationality and responsibility and getting into this ungrounded state. And for me, one of the ways to guard that is to notice that tendency in myself. Like, am I desiring to give up my decision making? Am I looking for an easy way out in this spirituality thing? Am I using spirituality to bypass myself? And I think that's one way of guarding against some of these dangers. And they are real, and there is manipulation within spirituality. But I think that one of the great things that coming out of religion does is it's taught us to examine rationality and to dive into critical thinking. So we have a really good foundation now for exploring spirituality, because we tend to be in tune with our kind of occult radar, our manipulation radar. So I encourage people to explore. But when I left religion, you know, I actually moved out to California, and I live in the Bay Area, and I was constantly tormented in my soul by all this new age talk, things about astrology and reincarnation and Eastern religion. I was so triggered by it. And I said to myself, this is all bullshit. This is more religion, just in different language. That's what I said. And then I've just been beside myself, and my world has been constantly blown open, finding that some of these things reflect experiential realities that I've had and that I see all around me, and that there's so much to it.
Well, I like what you said about being triggered, because I think that speaks to a lot of people, and maybe that explains in some cases why ex-Christians or ex-religious people are so wary of the whole thing, because you say there's manipulation out there and all kinds of other, there are very real dangers. We can actually fall back into another different trap that we kind of freed ourselves from by leaving religion. We're out of the frying pan and into the fire. But yet, there's got to be a way to explore it in healthy, more balanced ways, like you're saying, and addressing the fact that we're being triggered by some of this stuff. Because, I mean, I remember hearing all the same warnings. You know, New Age is all a bunch of, that's again, demonic manifestations, and it's trickery and all the rest of it. So, yeah, we can become triggered by that too.
Yes. Recently, in an interview, I called myself an atheist, and now I'm kind of regretting that, or like really wanting to explain what I meant.
I shouldn't have said that.
Because Because what I mean by that is, like, I don't believe in a deity outside of the natural world or the separate realms of spirit and matter. I think it's all a unity. But I notice a lot of even religious people tend to critique atheism, and I see what they're saying now. And that is, there can tend to be this closed-minded, dogmatic approach in atheism, a lack of openness. It makes sense to me. It really does make sense. So I want to validate that. But I hear a rejecting of the validity of experience, and that everything has to fit into this narrow empirical grid. There's a demand for evidence and for proof. And it's great when we have scientific proof for things. I love that. And I do think that we need to base our lives on things that make sense. But that being said, there are all kinds of experiences that we don't have the tools to quantify. There's a tendency to reject those out of hand and to not even consider that there might be some validity to them just because they don't fit into this framework, because they sound like religion. And this is a form of closed-mindedness and dogmaticism. And I've really noticed that whenever I talk about my experiences with, say, psychedelics or mindfulness, or even my exploration of Eastern religion, people will tend to reject it because it's experiential, or just say, we can't prove it, and then shut off paying attention to it, when there is a lot of rationality to it. But it's also kind of a different way of approaching things. And it's not comfortable. It doesn't fit comfortably into this kind of proof system. I would like it to, but it just doesn't.
It doesn't work all the time. And like you say, you can be just as fundamentalist and be an atheist as a fundamentalist Christian about your own beliefs. And like you say, have this closed-minded, dogmatic sort of reaction to everything. If it doesn't fit in my preconceived grid, I'm going to reject it out of hand. Well, that can't be a healthy way to live either. What would you say to someone who's coming out of religion, is now thinking, you know, Andrew, I'm interested in this whole thing, exploring spirituality. I'm really wary of a lot of stuff, and I don't want to be manipulated and misled. What's a good place to kind of start exploring this idea of spirituality?
A couple of things. One, I guess I encourage people to maintain a posture of openness. And so closed-mindedness is the doorway to dogmatism, and that got us into the dangers of religion in the first place. And it prevents us from seeing reality and from growing, being open to new experiences. We tend to get caught in fundamentalism in this all-or-nothing approach. And really the way life is it's a learning process, and there's a trial-and-error element to it. You know, sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. But sometimes I can see atheists getting into this just fear-based view where they're not open enough and they're not actually considering evidence. They're just rejecting it a priori, just because it doesn't fit this narrow empirical grid neatly. So I'd say there's a way to go about it. Continue being grounded in rationality. Ask yourself, am I being authentic to myself? Because real spirituality, the heart of it, is empowerment. It's having access to yourself and being connected to reality. It's really about understanding reality properly. It's about wisdom. What is reality, and how do I align myself with that? So it should result in more health and less confusion. Tuning into intuition, following your heart, understanding how reality works. And there's a freedom and a beauty to exploring spirituality. And it results in greater creativity, greater openness, greater sense of connectedness. So I really think that we're really well prepared, actually, as people who used to be in religion, because we're sensitive to manipulation. We've been under dogma. We know what that's like, so we can smell it a mile away a lot of times.
Yeah, we've been there, done that. Where's a good place to start? Because I think a lot of people, as I say, they wall that side of themselves off because of the background and the abuses and the trauma and the manipulation that they've experienced in religion. So where's a good place to start? Because spirituality, it can go under a lot of names and guises. There may be nothing there. I don't know. This is something I'm asking genuinely for myself, because I've kind of realized, I think to be a more holistic person, we need to embrace that spiritual side of ourselves. But yet I'm kind of going, I'm not sure where to start. Meditation and centering prayers and things like that, that might be a good place to start. I don't know. Where did you kind of go when you started exploring that side of things?
I first started started experiencing spirituality through psychedelics. When I experienced these non-ordinary states of consciousness, these different ways of experiencing reality, my mind was totally blown. I just experienced tremendous internal healing and a sense of connectedness. I'm not telling people necessarily to use those, but I'm very involved in that community. I found a lot of light there. Things like mindfulness and meditation, Buddhist psychology, and Eastern spirituality. There's actually centuries of philosophical wisdom to these traditions. I was shocked when I started studying them and taking them more seriously. Sometimes they can be very rationalistic in the way they approach states of consciousness and emotion, and just cosmology itself. So there are all kinds of things, but one of them I would say is to be in nature. Have you ever heard people say that I feel spiritual when I'm in nature?
Yeah, my sister was saying that she feels like when she goes hiking in the mountains of the Pacific Northwest, that's kind of her church, quote unquote, now. That's where she experiences some sense of the divine, again, in air quotes. But yeah, she definitely feels connected with nature, no doubt about it.
And so this is a really fascinating topic. One of the quickest ways to access spirituality is through being in nature. Now, why is that? It's because spirituality, and I'm going to get into some of my thoughts and hypotheses about spirituality. Realize I'm playing with these. Please think about them. These come out of my personal experiences and my thoughts.
Yeah, so be open-minded.
So spirituality is the realization that we are nature. It is a realization of connection, a consciousness of the aliveness of everything. And it's interesting, even the religious find themselves worshiping nature, like standing in awe of a sunset, and then they compulsively attribute it to God's glory.
Yes, right? Of course, the creator God.
But so one of the things that these non-ordinary states of consciousness we can achieve in meditation or yoga or psychedelics, is a common experience that comes out of it is the sense of the unity of all things, the sense of my consciousness is connected to, or I can experience, say, even animals and plants. I've often experienced a sense of my consciousness moving past my body and like being in the bodies of other things, or a state of non-duality is a very common experience of actually feeling connected to everything. And I think because everything is alive, in a sense, like the whole universe functions like a living organism, and we're connected on an atomic level to everything. Like a small change in my atomic nature will change you and shift things. There's a sense in that everything is connected and we are a part of nature. We're not outside of it. And when I understand that I'm connected to everything, that I'm nature, it's impossible for me to be alone, to feel alone, because aloneness is an illusion that's only possible when you don't see your connection to everything else that's alive. And not only that, but a sense of being connected to nature makes it hard for me to be destructive, because it's hard for you to, I don't see many people walking around hitting their own feet with a hammer.
Yeah.
It's like this sense arises of the unity of all things. So for instance, Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, right?
Yeah.
But through my experience of spirituality, I love my neighbor because my neighbor is myself, because I've experienced my neighbor as myself. And since there's this sense of oneness and continuity and connection, that means that it's harder for me to harm. And I see love as a thread that holds reality together. So loving the other as myself and experiencing the other as myself makes love make more sense and more real to me.
We've cut ourselves off from the natural side of things for sure. And I think what you're talking about in your article on this is this idea of worshiping God is somehow worshiping our own ego. We've cut ourselves off from nature, and you can see the resulting damage to both the animal kingdom and the environment, I think, because of those kinds of things, those kind of moves that people have made, maybe not consciously aware of how they got there, but they definitely need to reconnect, I think, on that level with nature. But I think it's interesting that you put the spirituality piece in there to say that's one of the fastest and most quick ways to connect with spirituality is through nature.
Yeah, and it tends to bring an understanding of non-duality and the unity of all things. My understanding of spirituality is that, like, this hierarchy and division between natural and supernatural doesn't exist. Like, even the term spirituality is an outdated category created by religion. I mean, ultimately, we're just approaching different aspects of ourselves from different angles. But, I mean, there's no separation between some kind of material realm or these different realms. It's all a unity. I think that, for me, spirituality has led to me connecting to myself, and this is how I found my healing from trauma, and I found the sense of purpose and been able to follow my heart. Is connecting to the sense of aliveness and seeing my place in terms of understanding reality and my connection to it, particularly experientially.
And maybe that's abstract enough for someone who's listening to what you're saying to go, okay, Andrew, I don't know what that looks like for me, but that's kind of where I need to go. I need to discover that oneness. I need to discover my place in this whole thing. What does that look like? We don't know. It's going to be different for everybody, isn't it? Because you're not saying, hey, go throw off your clothes and go run screaming into the woods and never come back. And that's your worship of nature. You got to keep the head on your shoulders, as you say, keep your critical thinking faculties intact, but you need to find something that's going to ground you and center you. And what, even if it's something simple, like starting out with some meditation, that's calming. And that's that, as you say, helps you deal with the traumas from our past. So that can only be a good thing, surely.
It is. And it's interesting that these practices from the East have really gained a lot of mainstream acceptance in the West. And they've been shown to heal people from anxiety, depression, and trauma, often more effectively than psychiatric medications.
How ironic. Often. You remember when the Beatles went over to India, that was kind of this idea of mocking them for abandoning Western philosophies and religions and going over to the East and getting sucked in by gurus and swamis in India and places like that. And even there's that reaction to the kind of thing you're talking about. And yet there's got to be a profound level of wisdom. This isn't stuff that was invented 5 minutes ago. These guys have been doing this for thousands of years. And there's a lot of profound insights that they've gained. So yeah, there's a lot that we can learn for sure from Eastern philosophy, Eastern religions, different worldviews other than the ones that we may have been exposed to in the West, for sure, huh?
And our religious experience gives us a great foundation with which to explore that. Having a good head on our shoulders and valuing our own experience and our own wisdom.
Yeah, it's not all bad.
It's a really safe and good place from which to explore these things. And I found my healing from my trauma through meditation, through Buddhist philosophy about emotional states and emotional healing, Buddhist psychology, transpersonal psychology, a whole field of psychology through psychedelic healing. You know, all of these things are how these spiritual practices are actually how I found the most healing. So it's quite a profound thing worth exploring.
Definitely worth exploring.
And keep your skepticism, you know. Again, it's beautiful that we can do this.
Well, and it's a way to integrate our past. I think that's an important piece of this reconstruction, is not just completely jettisoning the person that we were, as you say. We learned a lot. We learned critical thinking faculties and a lot of other things. And so we can use those in the exploration of spirituality in ways that are not going to be toxic and manipulative and all those other things that maybe we experienced when we were in religion. How can people get a hold of you if they want to explore this more? You've got a blog that you do a lot of writing on. What's the blog address and what's your kind of social media handle? How can people get a hold of you?
Yeah. My blog is lifeafterdogma.org, and you can get a hold of me through there.
That's the best way.
You can also find me on Facebook, Andrew Jasko, J-A-S-K-O. So those are the main ways you can find me, and or Andrew Jasko on Twitter as well.
Yes, you are on Twitter.
I've written hundreds of pages of blog articles on topics the abuses of religion, trauma, and spirituality, Eastern thought, and sexuality. But one other thing I'd like to touch on, if we have a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is, I think spirituality is a way to heal trauma by transcending it.
Right, and rising above
and
it somehow.
And connecting to the core of ourselves, what makes us us, to my aliveness, to my natureness. To what makes me alive, which is also could be called my sexuality, my life force, even my divinity, if you want to use these terms. But because when we try to approach trauma from the perspective of healing trauma, we're still in the disease and trauma-based framework, and we're never really getting past it. But when you connect to something that makes you you, something that makes you fully alive, you're no longer even focused on pathology. And so that's immune to trauma because it has nothing to do with it, because it's a core that's something else. That the core is really life itself. And being alive and experiencing this aliveness and sense of unity is, I think, at the heart of spirituality. And religion can be seen as a system that's based on trauma. Sometimes it looks like a traumatized individual trying to resolve his trauma in unhealthy ways, because a lot of it is a response to human suffering, that the problem of suffering, how do we deal with human suffering? And one of the ways religion has tended to do this is by self-blame, by saying suffering is my fault because I've sinned, so I beat myself up with self-loathing. Or it's someone else's fault. I project the blame onto someone else in the form of divine punishment. But what we're doing there is we're caught in this trauma cycle by blaming and by judging. And the way to resolve the trauma is to step outside of it in a way.
It's about transcending our trauma, not just dealing with it from, again, that maybe Western kind of point of view.
And also accepting and understanding the place of suffering, that it's not all about good and evil. There's a sense in which it is, that it's this fundamental fact to existence. And half of our psychological problems, I'm discovering, come from trying to escape painful and negative experiences and from judging everything as good and bad. And when we start to approach life from the perspective of compassion and awareness, accepting all aspects of ourselves, we start to experience this wholeness and this unity and this access to my aliveness, finding my flow state and my inspiration, and being able to work hard and have all those good works and power and heart transformation that we sought in religion.
It's so ironic that so much of what religion promised us ends up not, they never deliver on it somehow. And they have to go around it, as you say, and find alternative paths. And there you discover the very thing that they kept promising us all along. It's the ultimate irony, isn't it?
It is. I mean, most of it is behavior modification, behaviorism. I mean, it really leaves us kind of in a state of toddlerhood.
Do this, don't do that, right, wrong, that dualistic thinking. When we start thinking about trying to approach spirituality, I think in the first place, you know, we have those categories in our mind. And that can cripple us to approaching spirituality.
Yeah. So Christianity can lead us in this kind of toddlerhood-like state where it's about do this and don't do that and behavior modification. And that works for a certain stage of life, but it doesn't really affect true moral and spiritual development, which comes from the heart, comes from self-empowerment. It comes from having your own experiences and exploring the universe, exploring life, asking questions, being open. And so I really encourage that. And enjoy your newfound spirituality. You have a whole lifetime to develop your beliefs. You don't have to define yourself. This is your freedom, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. It can be fun, too. It doesn't have to always be serious. There are no eternal consequences anymore. And I guess I can throw out two names too that might be helpful to some people.
Yeah, what do you have for resources?
There's a guy named Jack Kornfield. He founded Spirit Rock Meditation Center. He studied in the East and also Western psychology, so he's a very big meditation psychology teacher. Another guy named Alan Watts, W-A-T-T-S. He used to be an Episcopal priest, and then he studied a lot of Zen Buddhism and Eastern thought. Really intelligent, articulate guy. He says a lot of some similar stuff. So those are just some starting points, but I'm new at this too.
This is all about exploring the journey, isn't it? We have to find something that works. So you've given us some good resources, some good tips and advice for how to start exploring spirituality. I agree that it's hugely important. It's got to be. I'm not willing to throw the whole thing out. Maybe there is no baby in the bathwater, but I don't want to throw the whole thing out just yet. So I'm with you. I need to explore this whole thing of spirituality. Well, listen, Andrew, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I've learned a lot again, as I did the last time. And I would encourage people to check out your blog for sure, because there's a lot of really good resources. It's very precisely written, And I think that's helpful for giving you the language to explain or validate your own experiences, especially if you're like me and yourself, Andrew, we're coming out of religion. We know what we're talking about. So it's very helpful to go through and read things like what you've written.
Thank you. And I also put myself out there. I love to talk and speak at events or put on talks like I'm doing with Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion. So if any of you are interested in that kind of thing, let me know.
Definitely get a hold of you, Andrew, and there's a lot of great resources that he's got. The seminar you did last time, you were able to do it online, is that right? Is there still a way to access that?
I'm looking to get a good recording of this one that I'm doing December 6th, so I'll probably put that on YouTube.
So there'll be a way to watch the video, even if you can't physically attend the seminar, so that's a great way to move forward and look at perhaps connecting with Andrew on social media or YouTube. Thank you so much, Andrew, for being on Mindshift Podcast again. I hope we'll stay in touch. Well, we'll definitely stay in touch. We'll see where this journey leads us.
All right. It's been a pleasure.
So what did you make of Andrew's recommendations for models or ways to explore spirituality? I like the fact that he said there's a lot of different things you can try. You've got to find something that works for you. But maybe this is the kind of critical point here that, as he says, we're looking for emotional health, emotional wholeness. And he says what emotional health looks like is being present with the fullness of your experiences. And that includes both the positives as well as the negatives. And he gave a whole laundry list of things you can try in terms of spirituality that might in fact help to heal you if you've been, like myself, damaged in terms of trauma caused by religion, your experiences in Christianity, whatever religion you came out of. Listen to all the things that he mentioned. He talked about psychedelics. He talked about meditation and centering prayer, mindfulness, Buddhist psychology, Eastern spirituality. And he said nature is the quickest way to get in touch with spirituality. And he said on that note, it reminds us that we are part of nature. Everything's alive. We're connected to it. It emphasizes the unity of all things. We're not alone, and therefore, it's hard to be destructive, and it's a non-dual sort of sense. There's this emphasis on the unity of all things. And so he says, just try it. Explore different experiences, explore different philosophies, but keep a critical head on your shoulders. The power is in the experience, not just the ideology. So hopefully Andrew's given you some great helpful tips, some things to think about, some ways to explore spirituality that might in fact help you to heal from religious trauma. Now, speaking of religious trauma, I was certainly traumatized back in 1988 when the movie The Last Temptation of Christ came out, along with every other evangelical and fundamentalist. We were completely outraged and scandalized. And this is something that we're going to be talking about next week with my returning guest. We got another returning guest, Seamus Clark. That's in air quotes. That's not his real name. He's going to weigh in, and we're going to have a really good discussion around this whole issue of the 30-year anniversary this year of the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. What does it say about Jesus? What does it say about the Gospels and how evangelicals, fundamentalists, and Catholics, how they reacted says really everything about not only where they were coming from 30 years ago, but now looking back three decades, what has been their response over the last 30 years, basically to that movie, to what they see as attacks on Christianity, attacks on the Bible, feeling persecuted. And of course, this helps to explain some of why that 81% white evangelical base voted for Trump and 68%, according to recent surveys, still continues to support him. They feel persecuted. They feel under attack, and the Bible is all part of that. So come back next week when Seamus Clark and I get into The Last Temptation of Christ. You're not going to want to miss that. It's a really good conversation about this movie and the reactions to it. All right. So thanks for joining me. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. You can always contact me with any of your thoughts, comments, questions. Get a hold of me on Twitter at MindShift2018. Send me your thoughts. I always look forward to talking to new listeners and hearing what they think about the show. So get a hold of me on Twitter. All right, I will see you along with Seamus Clark next Friday as we talk about the 30-year anniversary of The Last Temptation of Christ right here on MindShift Podcast.